order at 8:05. And present are Representative Keller, Representative Munoz, Representative Wilson, Representative Edmond, Representative Gardner, Representative Book, and Chair Seaton. And today we will be hearing an overview from the Department of Education and Early Development on teaching and learning support and the Office of Assessment and Accountability. So again, these are overviews, and I hope that the committee will take this opportunity to drill down into the questions we would have of the professionals that are conducting these things for our school system. So this is, you know, the best opportunity for us to talk about anything on assessments and accountability, as well as other sections of the department. So would you go ahead and introduce yourself? And thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Mark Lewis. I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Education. And with me, I have Les Morse, the Deputy Commissioner for the department. And what I'd like to do is I do want to thank you and the committee members for your thoughtful dialogue and the questions. And I do want to make very clear that I appreciate the fact that you wanted to have an open dialogue with us. And so if we do respond to a question and it's not totally up to what you expected, please feel free to tell us that you wanted a different set of information or that you want us to drill down a little deeper, because we'll be happy to provide that. And I just want to make sure that we are giving you the information that you're requesting. So please feel free to ask the question again or ask for more information if we miss the mark on that.
Very good. And I would like to also make sure that sometimes when I or other members might not ask a question that's quite as easily understood. So if you don't understand the question or you're interpreting it, go ahead and just restate it and make sure that we won't want to do these overviews in a somewhat informal way, though we'll still direct our comments through the chair to maintain order and all. But you know, don't be bashful about clarifying the question to make sure that you have a good understanding of what's being asked. So I appreciate that. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, would you like us to hold our questions till the end or ask questions as they come up?
I'll leave that up to you. If you don't have too formal a presentation, it might be more expeditious to go ahead and ask the questions as they come up. But if you have a presentation that you want to make in kind of an order and then come back, we can do that as well. What's your preference?
Mr. Chairman, I think actually as the questions come up would probably be appropriate, because it's not hard to just stop in the presentation to get to the question.
Okay, thank you. Then that's what we'll do.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we start? Proceed.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, with that being said, I wanted to address an issue that you presented last meeting concerning the Unity project, the longitudinal data system. You had requested information about the expenditures and the grant amounts that were funded. And if you would like, I would address that question now and hopefully get the answers you were looking for.
Sure, that would be
if that's okay with you. Okay. I just wanted to let you know that it was a U.S. DOE grant. We received $3.5 million for the award. It was a project that was scheduled to last from October of 2006 through October of 2008. It was scheduled to end this year, but we asked for a one-year non-monetary extension because we did have some setbacks, and they agreed to that. They let us continue on with the project with the current authorization, so we're now able to go through October of 2009 with the project using federal funding. In FY09, we actually received a general fund appropriation of $610,000 from the state to maintain the project, which was a requirement under the grant, and so we met all of our obligations there. So far, we've spent $2.5 million on the project. We have about $770,000 left of the general federal funding, and we still have most of the $610,000 of the general funds. We've had some issues with staffing. It's hard to find qualified analyst programmers in the state. It's very competitive right now, and so what we've had to do is go outside to find contractors, and we've been able to be pretty successful with that. There's a couple of outfits in Anchorage that have managed to fill in where we would normally have personal or staff do the programming for us, but they've been able to come in and step up to the plate for us on that. But it did get us behind a little bit.
Mark, and just before you go on, would you just kind of summarize the longitudinal data set, you know, that analysis of what we're doing on that program, just for those people that weren't here?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what this does is it automates the data collection that we get from the school districts. In the past, we've received different formats. They could be Excel files. They could be text files. It's essentially the collection that Deputy Commissioners and Eric McCormick's group collects upstairs for the assessment unit. And so as that information comes in, they have to go through and make sure it's clean data. They have to fix any errors that they find. And it was a real manual, labor-intensive process. And this system is supposed to help automate it so that as the data comes in, there's a cleaning process, what they call the state report manager, which actually can identify errors. And just as an example, if there is a numerical character in a field that's supposed to be just text, it'll flash there's an error. So there's a lot of basic elements that can be corrected automatically by telling the districts they need to clean up certain fields. And so from a real basic level, what this process does is it allows the system to clean the data for us before we actually review it and put it into the system. And there still is a quality control issue there where the department will have to actually go through and manually make sure that the new system is working as well. And that the data that we put into the data warehouse, once the information comes in, it goes into a data warehouse, and that's going to be where the records are stored. And so the research can occur once it's in the data warehouse. And the other element of this that we're trying to automate is what they call the web portals. And what this does is allows web access to people who have the right security levels to go in, and they can actually do their own research and drill down to certain levels depending on their security access. The people in the districts that that have the correct security can actually drill down to the student level data. And the ultimate goal is to be able to make quality data driven decisions based on the information over a period of time. And so that's what the longitudinal data system is in a nutshell. And actually, Les, if you have more clarification on it, but that's kind of the basic elements of the data warehouse concept.
I think we have a couple of questions on it. Before we go to those, would you just, now we're talking about student data. Are we also talking about the data, budget data or expense data that the commission that's going to be looking at geographic cost differential can use, or is this predominantly school-driven performance data?
Mr. Chair, right now it's performance data, and it's related to the student identifiers so that they can be tracked. There is no financial data. It is anticipated in the future that we would be able to add that element, but it's not a part of it at this point in time.
Okay, thank you. We had two questions. Representative Gardner, I believe, and then Representative Keller.
Thank you. You talked about the timelines and getting an extension from the federal government. My assumption is that what we're doing here is setting up a system that will be ongoing after the deadline, and the deadline it has to do with the length of time it takes us to get the kinks ironed out and the system set up so that it exists afterwards. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, that is correct, and that's what the general fund support that we received last year, that's going to continue as the maintenance portion so that we can continue on with the project.
Thank you. And set another
follow
question.
Up, Representative Gardner.
Actually, another question, but you talked about staffing issues and how you couldn't find Alaskans to do the programming, and so instead of getting your own people on staff, you had to go out of state and have a contractor come in and do it. Do you have any sense of whether that is a direct result of our state employment terms or retirement system and pay scale?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, I need to clarify that. Actually, the contracts that we had awarded was through a competitive formal solicitation. So we did have out-of-state contractors bid on that. What I meant to imply with the staffing issues was that we didn't go out of state to find additional programmers that weren't related to the formal solicitation. It was actually issues with our infrastructure within the department, and we did use Alaska vendors to do that. So I just want to make sure that I'm clear on that. The formal solicitation did award the contract to an out-of-state vendor, but that occurred through a competitive process. So it wasn't something that that we had hadn't anticipated because of the fact that this is a unique project. There are only a certain number of vendors that could actually even execute something at this level. And so it was anticipated that there would be out-of-state vendors for the large contract.
Thank you. And just a
follow-up, Representative Gardner.
So it was never your intention to actually hire anybody as a direct employee for the Department of Education, but rather to award a contract to somebody to do it?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, there are actually several elements to that. Staffing was required under the grant, and we did have staff when the grant was initiated. So there are two elements. We have internal staff that are required, and then we had the external element to complete the majority of the contract. With that being said, that's where we ran into some issues with the level of analyst programmers that we had on staff. We had lots of turnover. We had issues with the skill sets that you actually needed to have in-house to help pull this off. So we did have issues with it because of certain, I don't know if it's a statewide issue per se, where the salary schedules aren't, you know, based on market-driven data or whatever. There probably are some issues with that, and I'm hoping that with this new administration, the administration is addressing that. They have looked at it. They do see that there is an issue there, and they are trying to address it. So we have to continue on with our progress while they're doing what they need to do on that side of the arena.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
Representative Keller.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark or Les, what is the timeline for when teachers will actually be able to go to this database? And is there a goal in the department, you know, so that when they get a group of students, they can go in and know using the database what performance level each student is at? And I'm assuming that's the goal, but have we set a time that we want to be there?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, actually what we do, I can tell you, we did collect the fall data with some pilot districts using this system, and those districts were Juneau, Sitka, Kodiak, Delta Greeley, Mat-Su, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. And then with the spring collection using this system, we hope to pilot with Juneau, Sitka, Kodiak, Delta Greeley, Mat-Su, Fairbanks, Northwest Arctic, Galena, Wrangell, and Copper River. Now, when we get to the point where it's fully implemented, I'm not sure of the exact timeline on that, and I don't know if Les has that information off the top of his head either, but I'd be happy to get that for you if we don't have it today.
Thank you.
Through the chair, some of the time.
Would you identify yourself on
For the record, my name's Les Morris. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education.
And just when you guys switch back and forth, when it's not a direct response, would you make sure you just identify yourself by your name for the Secretary as we go forward?
Thank yes. Through the chair, Representative Keller, at this point, there's a system that allows us to go in and look at the data, and the department is testing that by making sure the data is accurate and what we're collecting is accurate. After next year, when we're moving to implement those with all the districts, we'll be in a position where we can work with the districts to assign those privileges in terms of who would be able to have access within the district to that data. And it will, in terms of getting down to the teacher level, we have a lot of work to do in terms of working with each district to determine their security levels and who can look at the data, because you have to ensure that teachers are only looking at their students and those types of things. So that, I don't know that we have enough information in terms of working with each district to give you an exact answer to that, but I can tell you the time frame would probably be during the next academic school year, where we would be working that out with each district.
I'll follow up, Representative Keller.
Yeah, thank you. I was under the the impression that's where we're going in the end, and that's great. And I was just have you looked at professional development, assigning the districts, and then is there going to be a system for helping teachers use this?
Through Representative Keller, through the chair, the part of the grant was actually required a professional development component so that the people within the districts would know how to use the systems that we're putting in place. Even with the state report manager, which is collecting the data that we just began piloting, there is a professional development component each time we do that. And so as we roll out new components, there will be professional development. And within the department, we're trying to think about how to effectively do professional development in a way that allows us to take advantage of distance education in many arenas, and we're certainly going to have to do that within the Unity project, this data warehouse.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm not sure which one of to direct this to, Mark or Les, but I kind of want to go back to Representative Gardner's question just a little bit to clarify in my mind. When and from what I understand is just to get this in place, you had to have people with probably higher levels of knowledge to put it together and put it to get it going. Do any time that your department comes across not being able to hire someone because we don't have them in Alaska, do you go to the Department of Labor and let them know right away that there's a shortage in Alaska so that they know what to put the emphasis on, what areas that we're lacking? Does that happen at all? Is there a communication between departments?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, actually the way it occurs is we use a hiring tool in the executive branch called Workplace Alaska. So we would post a job recruitment on Workplace Alaska, and if we do have what they call a failed recruitment where you don't have an adequate labor pool to actually make a selection, then the Department of Administration would collect that data. And if we went through several aspects of that where we had recruitments up for like multiple occasions and they fail every time, other departments are experiencing the same thing, the Department of Administration would track that, and then they would try to find out what the reasons are. And I'm sure that there would be some communication as to certain fields that Alaska is having problems recruiting for.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Gardner.
One last quick, very basic question. The longitudinal data study, does that allow us to see how specific, or when it's all implemented and everything's up and running, how a district is doing, how a building is doing, how a teacher's students are doing? I mean, can you sort it in all these different ways, and how one student is doing over time? Is that the idea?
Again, for the record, my name is Deputy Commissioner Les Morse, and through the chair, Representative Gardner. The system, currently we can do that, it's just more difficult, and the intent behind the longitudinal data system is to make that much more automated and allow districts and researchers with the right security level clearance to also do those kinds of analyses. And so it will depend on the kind of data we have, but looking at individual students and growth is something we currently do. Looking at schools and their performance over time is something we currently do. We currently don't look at that down to a teacher level within a building. While a district could do that at the state level, we don't necessarily have all the data to do that, but it is something that would be possible with the system in the future.
Thank you.
Okay, and thank you for bringing up that, because there was confusion on that and getting that answered right away. Go ahead with your presentation.
Okay, and one last thing on the follow-up, Mr. Chairman, on the bandwidth issue.
Okay, and again, then Mark.
Oh, I'm sorry, for the record, this is Mark Lewis. We did look into the bandwidth issue, and it isn't going to be a problem. The files that come across are going to be in text format, so they're a really small profile. They can actually be compressed to, or what they call a zip file. And currently those are being emailed, or they're sent to an FTP site or something similar to that, so it's not going to have an impact, and we've thought that through, and it's actually shouldn't be a problem for us.
I appreciate you checking on that, Lewis.
So if you will, Mr. Chairman, what I'll do now is I'll just give you a real high-level overview of what the core services are for teaching and learning support, and then when I get through with this, I'll go back to the budget document that Eddie had originally from the last meeting, and I'll just real quickly go through some of those elements with you if you don't mind. So as far as the core services go for teaching and learning support, this section provides leadership and technical assistance to schools related to state and federal education requirements and strategies that will result in improved student success, provide assistance to parents, families, schools to achieve greater involvement in students' education, administer statewide testing and assessments, provide technical assistance to district staff and collect and analyze data, provide ongoing and daily technical assistance to grantees related to increased student achievement, educational improvement, school health and safety, administer and provide technical assistance to schools and on school choice options such as statewide correspondence programs and charter schools, issue and administer state and federal grants, contracts, reimbursable services agreements for the provision of direct student instruction and professional development, administer teacher certification, National Council for Accreditation of School Teaching, or of Teaching Education, Teacher Education, I'm sorry, and assure quality of in-state teacher preparation programs. And they also administer the youth in detention and special schools. With that, if you would please turn to page two of the budget document, just to give it some context. In the section that's under agency operations, the teaching and learning support RDU has several components. We have student and school achievement, we have the statewide mentoring program, teacher certification, child nutrition, and early learning coordination. And I'll just point out that the early learning coordination is actually where the Head Start is housed, and you have that scheduled on the calendar to address at a different time because it can take up a lot of time, so I won't spend much time on that today. If you look across the spreadsheet there, you'll see that student and school achievement has 70 positions. We have about $8.5 million in general funds, $155.6 in federal funding, and then $1.3 in other funds. The statewide mentoring program has about $3.9 million of general funds and $600,000 in interagency receipts. The teacher certification unit is mostly supported with the receipt supported services funding, which is the fees for teacher certification. The child nutrition program has about $8.6 in general fund match, and federal funding is at about $35.5 million. And then the early learning component, which is Head Start grants, we've got about $7.8 million, $256,000 in federal funds. And also on there you can see that the positions that are allocated, like I said before, 70 for student and school achievement, 5 for teacher certification, 9 for child nutrition, and then 3 people for the early learning coordination.
Mark, before you go on, just clarification on the child nutrition. So am I reading this that there's $35 million from the federal government and there's $86,000 total from the state GF for
Mr. Chair,
child nutrition?
That's correct. And so if you turn back to page 9, we have another spreadsheet that basically breaks down teaching and learning support into the various programs.
Which page was that again?
It's on page 9 and 10. And we found this spreadsheet to be very helpful. If you look across, we've broken it down by the funding source. So if you go down the left-hand column, it gives the program. You move to the right to see what the funding source is for that program, then it gives you a total and an approximate number of positions that are allocated to each one of those. And I won't go through the detail on this because it's not really a budget exercise, but this gives you the opportunity to get a high-level view of how the resources are allocated within this component.
So if you don't mind, Mark, let's just take an example. Let's go halfway down there and say state assessments.
Okay.
Okay, so we've got nothing in the federal column, and then we have in the federal NCLB, No Child Left Behind column, and so that'd be $3.7 million?
That's correct.
And the difference between federal and federal NCLB for our...
Mr. Chairman, we actually broke this column out because we did have it all rolled up into one as federal, but someone had requested at one point in time well, how much of that is really directed toward fulfilling fulfilling NCLB requirements? And so we decided to break that out. So if it's not related to NCLB, but it's federal, we have it in the first column. But if it's directly related to the NCLB, we put it in that column.
And that funding is coming from the federal government to implement that portion. Is that correct? And that's where that federal, or is that the where we're expending federal funds that we have to fulfill something, or is that money that's directed to the state through NCLB?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to ask the director of TLS to clarify that when she comes up to the table, but it's my understanding that it's to fulfill the requirements under NCLB, so we do get that money directly from the feds to fulfill that requirement. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On the special ed, I see that there's 34 million. Is that?
And where are we, down towards the bottom?
It's about an inch down on the left side, special ed. It has a federal component and no general fund. And can you tell me how many students would fall under the service category for that funding? And would that include fetal alcohol kids for services, any kids that have IEPs?
Mr. Chairman, I'll have to take that question and get the research and get back to you on that. So just for clarification, could you please repeat the question?
Okay. The funding we have for special ed, I'm interested in knowing, is that the total funding that we put into all the kids who have IEPs for those services? I mean, how does this break out? And the reason it's of particular concern to me is as we talk about trying to improve our graduation rates, and I had previously asked for information down the road about who the kids are who are not graduating, and so I'm trying to tease out, are they kids who got special services and we didn't meet their needs, special ed services, of the dropouts, or how are we doing on kids who need, are we identifying all the children, are we meeting their needs when we've identified them? Or are we missing a pool of them? And part of my concern is that when I've talked with the Anchorage School District and they say they believe that they are identifying all the kids because they have the expected bell curve that's sort of the national average, I would wonder if Alaska shouldn't have more. We hear anecdotally that the military encourages kids with special needs, people who have kids with special needs to come here because we have good services for them. We know we have a huge alcohol problem and other social problems that impact student success, and some of those kids we would anticipate should have IEPs and get additional services. So are we putting the money where our mouth is, and is this someplace we should really examine if we try to improve graduation rates?
Thanks. And before we get too deeply into that, we do on Wednesday the 28th have on that overview is going to be overview of early childhood programs, Head Start, and other in-school programs in Alaska regional schools. And I don't know if that is too crowded a schedule for 2 hours to have a segment on overview of special ed. We're going to need that, and we don't have it on our overview schedule, correct? I mean, I'm hearing you wanting to drill down into special ed, and I think most of us are going to want to do that as well. So with that amount, do you think that that's too crowded a schedule to add something in on special ed, or do you think it needs more time?
Mr. Chairman, I think the 2 hours would probably be adequate to address that. And I would like to respond to, I believe that on within this program, the special ed allocation that's federal is most likely directed toward monitoring and compliance, and I believe that the special ed that you're referring to is the money that flows through the foundation formula directly to the school districts to implement their programs.
Got it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chairman.
Okay, and let me just before we go on, let's clarify that on Wednesday we will have as a specific under the other in-school programs, we will have special ed as part of that other in-school program. So I just want to put the department on notice so that we would expect that with the other topics for that overview. But I'm not meaning to cut off conversation here.
No, that's perfect.
Representative Edgman, and then Mugnot, and Keller, and Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to get a comment on the small rural school achievement. It's listed $170,000, and then below that, estate assessments for $3.7 million. And just trying to get some sense of whether those two programs work with each other, and then that the $170,000, if you consider the 200-plus smaller schools that are around the state, really seems like a small number, but that's given the fact that I really don't know what it does. So any comment on that would be appreciated.
Can you answer that one? Okay.
Mr. Chair, can I get on your list?
Sure.
Please? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I've asked Cindy Curran, the director of TLS, to come up to help answer some of these questions.
TLS?
Yeah, Teaching and Learning Support.
Thank you.
Good morning. Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the Small Rural Schools Achievement Program is a federal program that allows districts with small enrollments to be able to combine federal funding to use in other federal programs, so that a school district could use Title IV funds if they got a small amount and roll them up to add to their Title I funding to help their students.
Okay, so just a quick follow-up. There's no relation.
Representative Edgman.
There's no, essentially no relationship then with state assessments.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, no, there's no direct relationship.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Mino.
Hello, thank you very much. I'm curious, under the counseling, suicide prevention, and at risk, the amount is $39,800 and seems awfully low, and wondering if you could speak to that item and or that part of the budget, and how maybe there's possibilities to work with school districts or the federal government to increase those funds.
Through the chair, Representative
Mugnot. Is it 39 million or 39,000?
It is 39,000.
Oh, yeah, okay. 39,000.
Oh, yeah. Through the chair, Representative Mugnot, I apologize, I didn't catch all of your question.
Oh, just under suicide prevention, 39,000 seems very, very low, considering the epidemic levels of suicide across the state, especially in rural Alaska, and wondering what the department's goals are to increase funding in that part of the budget.
Through the chair, Representative Mugnot, I believe that the department is working with the Department of Health and Social Services on programs. I will get you as much information as I can on that.
And just one more follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Mugnot.
And then also I'm interested in the Alaska Mineral and Education Resources Fund. If you could just speak to what that fund is used for and how it's dispersed to the districts. Do you want to say
anything? Sure. Excuse me. Through the chair, Representative Mugnot.
And
this is Mark Lewis, the Admin Services Director. That money is actually given, it's a flow-through grant at this point in time that we give to the AMREF board to fulfill the contractual obligation that they have, where they have a school curriculum development process. They have a teacher that goes out, and actually they send out these kits, and they go into the classrooms, provide a curriculum to educate the students on mineral and energy resources within the state of Alaska. And so they actually handle the whole program now, where we just give them the money so that they can go out and provide that service to the districts.
Thank you.
And Representative Keller?
Yeah, this is just a general question about your chart. I assume that each category here, that's not a comprehensive list of all the revenue applied, and if it is, would you explain down on the longitudinal data system, for example, there's no grant money there. I thought we were getting, we spent 2.5 and we're receiving 3.5 federal, and all we have is a state, and I'm just trying to understand it.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Keller. excuse me. That's a good point. I just want to clarify, with this particular chart, it's to quantify where the funding level is at this point in time. So we don't currently have any new federal funding coming in, and this is actually to allocate what we have in the FY 2010 budget. So in the 2010 budget, we won't have any federal money associated with that program. It's extended through FY 09, but we don't have any federal funding for FY 10.
And I would assume that that kind of applies to all categories here. We've got to think about it in a broader sense. Excuse me.
Representative Keller.
Yeah, get a dialogue going here.
And through the chair, Representative Keller, you're absolutely right. And I do need to probably clarify that these are just estimates because the federal funding, it fluctuates somewhat. And so we give our best estimate on where we think the money is going to land during this fiscal year. And so if you actually go down at the very end of this particular component, and we have one in each one of the components that has a federal allocation, is there's an unallocated carry forward amount that kind of catches the amount that we don't have allocated per se. And so it does fluctuate, and it is only an estimate.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Yes, I do. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I do have a little comment for Kathy, because I have seen the kits, and they're big kits, and they're very, very nice. And there are rocks of each of the minerals, different minerals that's found in Alaska, and so that they can identify and come up and see what they look like. And then there's a lot of teaching lesson plans for the teacher to follow. So they're very nice. I was very impressed. Because they aren't just skimpy little things. They're pretty well defined and I think very nice. So I just wanted to make that comment. What I'd like to ask is, when NCLB came into being, the feds put money with that. However, at the same time they did that, they took money away from other areas that they were normally giving us, and I would like to know what areas that kind of the funding dropped, and now we're using the funding now for NCLB, and I would like to know what areas got less funding, and are we picking it up so that those areas are whatever the area, whether it's special ed or Title IV, or whatever the program, have we as a state picked that up, or have we dropped that and just expect the schools now to do what they were always doing without the money, because now the money is being directed for NCLB?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think that's a complex question. I probably will have to do some research on that to get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Booth.
Well, dovetailing with this question, through the chair, and pardon my ignorance, Mr. Chairman, maybe you know the answer already, but my question in looking at this and going back to probably a 50,000-foot view here is, in order to go forward, we really need to know where we're at and how we got there, you know, so we get current as far as I'm concerned. Representative Wilson's question, to my mind is when No Child Left Behind came along, there are mandates. Those mandates were supposedly, to my knowledge, were to be funded at a certain level. The reality is different. The funding level supposedly was around 44%, supposedly, from what I'm my experience and what my knowledge is, but the reality was somewhere between 14% and 16%. So I would like to get, you know, an idea of where we're really at here. I mean, it's rather confusing to me. We've actually slipped through the clouds. We're looking at particulars here, but I want to know generalities to begin with, so that I can get an idea of how we got here, so that we can proceed from here. That's a request. It's rhetorical. I don't expect an answer now.
And Representative Book, I think that you know, our goal in all these overviews is to get the entire committee up to a knowledge base on these programs. And they're, you know, none of us are really experts in this. This is the first time we've had this standing committee that has this broad spectrum of oversight. And so I think that what I'm hearing from committee members is we're going to need a section specifically on NCLB. We're looking at assessment and accountability, and although there's a good portion of that in NCLB is attempting to looking at that, I don't want to get this committee meeting too broad just looking at NCLB other than the assessment and the accountability section. So I think that what we'll do is we will schedule a overview presentation so that we all get up to speed on the breadth and the problems and all that with No Child Left Behind. And so if that's satisfying to you at this point in time, Representative Book, if there's a specific accountability question.
There is, but you mean, know, I think we're going to gain that. And I just want, this is sort of a an overview thought from the presenters that we know we need to know how we got where we are.
Okay. And is there anything that you guys would like to add on the accountability or the assessment portion of NCLB and in your presentation today?
Mr. Chairman, I believe Les Morse can address some of those issues. Excuse me.
Thank you. Les.
Again, for the record, my name's Les Morse, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education. And up until September and the previous 5 years to that, I served as the Director of Assessment and Accountability at the department. And so that's why I'll be speaking to assessment and accountability issues before you, because I know them quite deeply. I'll also talk about the technical assistance that we are doing under my current role as Deputy Commissioner for districts and some of our plans in the future, because I think it will dovetail quite nicely and be a nice transition to then introducing Cynthia Curran to come back up here and speak to many of the areas of teaching and learning support that does a lot of work in terms of federal compliance to the funds that we get from the federal level, but in addition, technical assistance that they offer.
And Les, is this comfortable for you taking this section of this and then coming back to teaching and support, or do you want to, does this work within your program, or do you want to switch the order in which we address these?
Chair Seaton, I think this will work quite nicely. It will also give me an opportunity to answer some questions, because I think came up at the last meeting around the performance incentive, because that falls within the accountability unit. And so first off, in terms of the assessment office, I want to make sure that you all are aware that there is a new director, but because I worked in that position for a number of years, I am presenting. But the new director is immediately to my left, Eric McCormick, who I worked with for 5 years. But the other thing is, Eric has worked at the department for a long time, probably longer than all but maybe a few people in the Division of Teaching and Learning Support. So he has a great deal of experience and really ran the accountability part of the assessment and accountability unit working with me for the last 5.5 years. There's two major functions in the assessment and accountability unit, one being assessment, and they oversee 7 statewide assessments that take place every year. And those assessments include the high school graduation qualifying exam. They include a developmental profile that every student who is coming into our system in kindergarten or first grade must participate in. They include our standards-based assessments, which is our largest and probably our most significant assessment, because that's what all of our school accountability is based on. And we test in reading, writing, and mathematics. Every student grades 3 through 10 and science at 3 different grade levels. They also oversee a norm reference test that's given to 2 grade levels each year, an English language proficiency assessment that's given to about 18,000 students each year who have limited English proficiency skills, alternate assessment for students who have severe disabilities. That's about 600 students each year. And then we work with the federal government to oversee the National Assessment of Educational Progress that gives us a snapshot of how our state's doing relative to the nation and other states. Again, I'll be addressing next some things about the, or shortly some things about the standards-based assessment, because it is our major assessment for accountability and the one that you will likely hear the most about when you talk to schools about student assessment. Over the past 5 years, that standards-based assessment, along with the high school qualifying exam, because we use the same contractor for both of those assessments, has been completely redesigned. We were working with a company about 5 years ago that we started working with probably one or two decades ago. And when we began to look at the system and what we were going to need to do to make sure we were providing Alaskans a solid assessment system based on the state's content standards that would both meet the state and federal requirements, it really came to our view that we had to step back and begin a complete redesign of the system for multiple reasons. We didn't own our assessments, so when we were finished with that vendor, they took them away and we didn't even own them. Now we own everything that we develop with this company, so if we had to switch companies, we would own our work. The other thing that happened as a process of going out to competitive bid to get something that we would truly own rather than really leasing, we were able to build our program, add some things that we think are more helpful to districts, and we saved money as we did that. Last year alone, if we were working with our previous vendor who made estimates out through FY08, and we compare what we would have had to pay them compared to what we did pay our vendor that we had last year that we started working with about 4.5 or 5 years ago, we saved approximately $2.4 million just in a single year. So those are the kinds of savings we made by going to competitive bid in that process and by really laying out what we needed and working with that vendor over the last 5 years. So we expect those kinds of savings each year at the same time that these kinds of costs have gone up dramatically, because all states are having to build assessments at all these grade levels. So this has been a very difficult sometimes to get really good vendors, and we do have a pretty good vendor, or actually a very good vendor right now. We have actually just went through a competitive process again and have announced recently the award to continue working with the same vendor, which is, the company's name is Data Recognition Corporation. Often districts will refer to them as DRC. That's their their acronym, and they're out of Minnesota. So we've been working with them 5 years. We'll be continuing to work with them through FY15 under our new contract arrangement. And the other thing I want to point out is we've gained new things. While we've saved just in last year $2.4 million, we have gained new services that were not things that we would have had we stayed with our previous vendor under their contract arrangement. So that's very important and powerful for us as well as our school districts. I'm going to leave assessment and address accountability. So before I do that, this might be a great time to address any questions of things I just raised.
Representative Gardner and Representative Boot.
Thank you. We are currently testing kids every year on reading, writing, arithmetic, and on science 3 times. Is that what you said? And I guess my question is, assuming that's accurate, is as a nation and as a state, when we have increasing evidence that we're falling behind in the hard sciences and kids are not going into those fields, it seems to me that maybe even the fact that we only test in the sciences 3 times is sort of indicative of the fact that maybe we're not putting enough emphasis on sciences. Is that fair?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, let me see if I can answer the question. You're correct, first off, that we do test every grade level 3 through 10 in reading, writing, mathematics. And then at grade 4, 8, and 10 is when we test for the area of science. The science is a new piece. We're just going into our third year of testing science this year, and it is The reading, writing, and mathematics is part of a state requirement as well as a federal requirement. And actually, the writing is not a federal requirement. That is in there because our state requires a test in writing. The science is not in state statute, not required by state statute, but is by No Child Left Behind. And so the requirement of meeting that mandate comes from No Child Left Behind and was brought into place to meet that mandate. In terms of students going to the hard sciences and its relationship to the science assessment, I think that as educators begin to get the data about how students are doing at all three grade these different grade spans, they'll begin to look harder at their curriculums in those particular areas to better address those student needs. So it would be my hope that the ultimate policy piece that we'd get out of testing in these areas, that we'd enrich our curriculums even better to help meet the students' needs.
Thank you.
Representative Boop.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm concerned in that, you know, several times throughout your presentation, we've talked about technical requirements regarding, you know, all of the data and all of that kinds of things, and it sounds like we're utilizing a resource out of the state. I'm just wondering how to better utilize our state, our resources, whether or not departments should have their own technical support, their own facilities, their own capabilities, so that we can maintain and create and enhance our own data without reinventing the wheel here. Certainly, all of these kinds of technological, you know, the hardware is getting cheaper, more accessible, the expansive capabilities that, you know, are there every day, make it more and more readily available. In this state, we have a couple of different agencies that have segregated technical support, and I'm just wondering if there's a way that we can look at this long-term that, you know, as far as education and all the rest of the departments are concerned, we're not going in, you know, various directions regarding the technical and data gathering capability so that you know, we can confine some of our expenses and utilize our own manpower, our own resources, our own data, like I said, without going out and reinventing the wheel entirely. So I'm just curious, what do we have in the Department of Education for technical support and facilities?
Do you want to address that?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I just want to make sure I'm clear that you're talking about the state's infrastructure for technology versus what he's referring to as in education for the sciences in the classrooms. Is that correct?
Well, it's integrated. I mean, you're talking about data gathering and use of that information, and you're also you're talking about it in functions with accountability regarding monies and resources. All of that dovetails together here. So, you know, the technical support of all of this stuff, I think, is more and more important as every day passes, so that we can utilize that information in a more effective and efficient manner.
Through the chair, Representative Book, in terms of a high-level, broad perspective with technology in the state of Alaska, we actually do have some consolidation. The Division of Enterprise Technology Services within the Department of Administration kind of oversees the backbone of the state system. And within that purview, we submit a state IT plan every year to show the Department of Administration and the Governor's Office what our intent is for any given year. And the purpose behind that is not only to help us plan what we may need, but it also is there so that if there is an opportunity to consolidate some services in a reasonable framework, that we would be able to, like, consolidate servers, or perhaps if we did have a system like this State Report Manager that other departments could use, that they could piggyback onto that, or we could use something that they're already doing. The issues that you have with that is every department really has its own mission, and sometimes they just do not fit well into something that that another department may be using. But I do have to say that there is an effort to look at each one of these items as they come forward to see if there's opportunities to consolidate and to make it more cost effective.
Thank you.
Representative Keller and then Representative Edgman.
Could you help me understand? Our standard-based assessment is a state-based assessment, and we have the NAEP, which is, as far as I know, the only testing available to compare our state with other states, and they consistently show us in the bottom half of the U.S. as a total. My question is, what do we do to make sure, like, make sure DRC? I mean, how do you look at that? I mean, do you? Is there a way to for us to think about the quality of the standard-based testing other than through looking at NAEP? You know, and because I'm always a little uneasy when I see our low performance on NAEP and our relatively good performance on the state, and I know that they're not testing. It's not apples to apples, but that's the only identifier that I know of, and I just wondered how the department looks at that.
Again, for the record, I'm Les Morse, the deputy commissioner, and through the chair, Representative Keller. We do have the standards-based assessment. We also have the NAEP, which gives us a comparison of to other states as well as to the nation and to certain subgroups where looking at performance. We do have one other assessment that's a norm reference test that allows us to take a look at how our students are doing relative to other students across the nation when through that test, and that's called the Terra Nova, and it's given at two grade levels, both I believe it's the fifth grade and the seventh grade that we give that test. So we have, again, the Terra Nova, which is a norm reference test, and the NAEP, which give us a picture of how we're doing relative to the nation, and then we can take a look at student performance relative to that norm reference test to how they do on the standards-based test and get a sense of where students are performing. They are, as you said, apples and oranges to some degree because they are different tests for different purposes. But we do take a look at student performance relative how they do in one assessment, particularly with the Terra Nova, and how they do on the standards-based assessment. And last year, to help our districts, because what we really want to do is make sure that our districts are really looking at that kind of analyses so that they look at student needs at the classroom level. So last year we did workshops with our districts through one of our vendors that was sponsored a workshop here in Juneau, one in Anchorage, one in Fairbanks that a number of districts, a good number of our districts attended to take a look at how could they look at this analyses of these two assessments and bring that information together, both to compare performance but then to look at the what is assessed on those assessments and make comparisons between the two assessments. One other point I want to make in terms of the NAEP is that our performance there, it's a fairly complex analysis, but overall we're certainly not in the top half, but we're not in the very bottom with the NAEP in terms of national performance. We actually are in a group of states that I don't feel our performance nationally is that poor because you have to begin looking at all sorts of other indicators. We have the largest number of students by percent, or we're in one of the top three states in terms of largest numbers of students by percent who are limited English proficient who participate in that assessment. So when we're looking at our performance, we also have to begin looking at which students took it because in our state we have more students that we would expect to perform more at a lower level on that assessment because where they are in terms of their English language proficiency. And so states have the right to exclude certain students from the NAEP, and we have what's called a low exclusion rate, which is something we're real proud of. It gives a better reflection of how we're doing, but you always have to look at that when you compare us to another state to make sure what is their exclusion rate. So you're right, we're in the lower half. We're not doing real poorly, though, in my view, and you have to look at those other indicators. But I think the main thing to address your question is we're working to to make this data available to districts so they can do analysis, look at their programs, their curriculum, and their individual student needs.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Thank you. And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of a follow-up question for what you just mentioned. I think you said that there were 18,000 non-English speaking students, or maybe not non-English speaking, but that had another language that they spoke at home, and that they were tested every year. Now, I know we get more students in every year, but we're losing some too, so not from graduation and whatnot. But how are we doing on that then in teaching them English, since it really makes a difference to each of those children, because they in America are going to do better if they can speak English? And I know we're mandated to help them with their language so that, or teach in their language at times, but the reality is that in America, if we can get all of our students speaking English, they will do better in society, because the jobs and whatnot are usually English-speaking jobs. So how are we doing in that area in the testing, since it reflects a lot of other things also? Are we improving in that? Do we need to put more emphasis on it? What is happening there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, let me clarify again. It's an approximate when I say 18,000. The numbers at one point were about 20,000. So we're somewhere I would say between about 16 and 18,000 right now. And in addition, let me clarify that these are limited English proficient students. Some of them speak a different first language and have very limited English proficiency skills. Others actually don't speak another language, maybe at a proficient level, but they're heavily influenced perhaps by an Alaskan native heritage language, but they have limited English proficiency. So that pool of 18,000 includes both immigrant students who are newer to our country, as well as students who may have always been in the state but have some limited English proficiency, and therefore we're working to make sure there's programs in place in the schools to increase their English language. The truth behind the question, I think, is that we are now identifying those students better than we've ever done within the last 2 to 3 years, because we assess them specifically on their English language proficiency in addition to their content knowledge through our standards-based assessment. We get that information and that data back to those districts that helps them begin to look at, is the challenge that student having, is it in reading or is it in writing? Is it in speaking? The test involves all of the, and it involves one other area, listening. It's a very intensive test to give so that you can begin to really look at all of those pieces. For me to speak in terms of these specific increases in performance, I think the only thing that I could indicate is that a few years ago we did have about 20,500 students, and we have exited students from the program. And so I know that by providing the data and looking at it more closely, we're able to address their needs at the local level. I wouldn't say that we are at the level where doing it where we think that we're doing good enough, because we have some targets districts need to meet, and we are providing information back, and they're at this point our districts are finding some challenges in meeting those targets. We do have some program work that we do around with some of our districts in that area that is part of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, and do some technical assistance in that area that Ms. Curran will be able to speak to probably more later on, or we could address at another time.
And I think Ms. Representative Edgman, did you have a question?
Yes,
thank you. Representative Edgman, I apologize for getting out of order.
Let's hope that's not the only time. No. My question is a 101 question. Last night we heard the governor talk about Road to Nome, Road to Umiat, a bullet line in 5 years. Certainly we know that there's a major effort to get a gas line in Alaska. There's major mining projects around the state. And so at some point here, we're probably going to have a labor shortage in Alaska if we don't I'm sure we do already in a certain aspect. So I'm trying to get a better understanding of how these seven assessments relate to vocational education, and if there is some kind of a identification process, if you will, because I'm thinking back to a conversation I had with somebody with the Alaska Working Workforce Investment Board, which I think we're going to get a presentation from at some point. But he was telling me that they're looking now at sixth and seventh graders in terms of identifying students who would have maybe more aptitude in the vocational education arena as opposed to going on into academia. So can you respond to that question and maybe give some insight into the intertie between vocational education and assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman. You mentioned what into an area that we actually have an eighth assessment. It just doesn't happen to be part of the assessment and accountability unit. We do have an assessment. I just forgot the name. It's the
Work keys.
The work keys. I've worked with it, but I didn't remember the name. The work keys assessment, which is actually, in terms of its administration, is housed in the career and technical education unit of the Teaching and Learning Support Division that Ms. Curran is the director of, and again, she'll be speaking as well today. But I can fill you in a little bit about that assessment. There is a high school component as well as an elementary and a middle school testing component in terms of the overall program. And we're able to take a look at students' vocational skills specifically within areas of reading and mathematics that and both provide the students more information as well as provide districts and the state more information, again, about programs and what things might need to change in terms of curriculum. We have been in a stage of piloting that assessment because it's a new assessment. It's typically done best if it's done on the computer because you can get feedback much more quickly. And so the state board has passed a regulation that to put that in as a requirement. At this point, we think that requirement will probably fall in place not next academic year but the following year. And at this point, we're working to administer it with as many districts as we can to pilot that and to get that put into place. That is one piece that's very connected. However, the rest of the assessments have skills embedded within them that address, you know, basic mathematics, basic reading, basic writing, which are also not just academic but vocational skills. So as people get in districts the data from those assessments, they can begin to drill down and really look at what are the skills that our students are deficient in and begin addressing those and be thinking about those that are probably more for someone who may be headed for more of an academic world of education versus an education world dealing more in trades training and those kinds of things. But the work keys assessment directly addresses those particular issues.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
Okay. Next, I want to address some issues around accountability just so that you're aware again of in the assessment and accountability unit that Mr. McCormick is the director of, in addition to the assessment, they run all the data around school accountability as well as other data collections and reporting functions to the U.S. Department of Education as well as state reporting. This includes things like the student performance data. They also collect teacher data and those kinds of pieces of information, and then work with the reporting of those things to both any state reporting as well as federal reporting. I want to be very specific about our accountability pieces. This unit does the adequate yearly progress calculations that come out each August and are reported to the districts. We also do some additional state level accountability reporting to districts that came about because of the passage of Senate Bill 285 last year, which required the state board to put in place regulations and required that we do an examination of every school in this state to see how they are performing and engage in a dialogue with those districts when there is low performance. In my current role, I lead those dialogues, and there we have had very good discussions with each of the districts. And that all came about in part because we care very much about student achievement, and if No Child Left Behind went away, what would we do as a state? And some of the things that were in SB 285 would be there regardless of No Child Left Behind. But it's also in part because of Moore versus Alaska, the lawsuit that we are trying to make sure that we're paying attention to student learning and making sure we're paying attention to making sure students have the opportunity to learn. So we do a lot of functions of looking at schools in this unit to address those needs. Also in this new unit does the Alaska School Performance Incentive Program calculations. That program was a three-year grant or three-year pilot program authorized by the legislature and funded by the legislature. It is in its final year, so we've had 2 years. We do collect data in addition to making the payments. We last year surveyed all of the people who received those rewards, and we looked at issues both of their perception about the program as well as trying to determine, is there something that those schools do that that caused them to win that award? And I think in some of the information that I had a chance again to examine last night, we really have looked at, there's a couple of problems that the program had. It had a fairly negative perception among educators in the state. And that itself created some problems for the program. Educators certainly, in some cases, felt offended that they would receive it and would turn around and we don't have any evidence of this, but we are told that the money was turned into donations to other entities. In some cases, I know teachers used the money to buy things for their classrooms because that's what they told us they did through the surveying. But there was a lot of anger about the program and felt that the money should be better spent. So one of the things that why the program struggled is the perceptions in terms of educators in the state. The other thing in terms of trying to find programs, we really found that many of these schools probably would have performed the way they performed regardless of the incentive. So it would need to be looked at very carefully to determine how we would have to change the current program if we wanted to continue to utilize it, because it truly didn't create increased learning. It appears we have rewarded people for learning that might have taken place. The closest I would say in terms of any innovation I heard is more in dialogue I had with principals, and I'm not sure I would call this innovation, but I would call it, there were principals who really used the growth data they can get from this program, which we will continue to calculate that growth data because we do think there's value in looking at how did this child do this year relative to how they do, this year relative to the prior year, and that information being something principals carefully look at and dialogue with their staff about that and talk about how they might work differently and together within the school to make sure they're wrapping services around each one of those students' needs. So out of this program, we will continue to do those calculations and provide that information to the districts. And in terms of anything I heard that might be, again, I'm not sure this is innovative, but it's good work. We had principals looking and understanding how those calculations are done, because they're done actually quite simply, and sharing that information with their staff to get them to wrap their heads around those students. So I hope that addresses the questions on the performance incentive that we have at this point. We, again, have one more year of the program, so we'll continue to collect data so that we have that information as to what's going on. Because if we ever were to look at something like this, we would want to use what we've learned to inform any type of incentive programs in the future.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I don't remember the specifics of this program. I remember the debate about it. Mm-hmm. And are the same schools eligible to win again?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. Yes, the same schools are eligible. It's a year. It's a calculation done every year looking at all of the schools in the state, how all students that were in that school for a significant period of the current year, how those students did relative to the prior year. And then it indicates what growth occurred based on an index score when you roll up the performance of all of those students. Really, again, valuable information. It was, and he would say schools found that information valuable.
Thank you.
Representative Gardner, follow-up?
Follow-up, yeah. In my office, we've looked at the schools that actually won, and to me, there weren't any surprises. There were schools, at least in the Anchorage area, that I know have very high parent participation and involvement. They're optional schools. They're schools that are sort of known for an active parent group, and I think that also can be expected to be reflected in children's scores. Yeah.
And just to qualify, is this the first time that, or first program that we've looked at growth year over year and looked at trying to identify, well, I guess we're not trying to identify at this point, what factors gave greater than anticipated growth students year over year instead of just basic or what's the top score? I mean, what, you know, if all we're doing is looking at scoring in 1 year, then it's dependent on the student, dependent upon how they came in. But, you know, but if we're looking at the growth model year over year and only those students that were in those schools, I think that that model gets us down to looking at individual students and how they learn or whether they did learn. And it seems to me that this was the first time that I've seen us really concentrating on that factor of education, which I think when it comes down to it is the one that's going to be meaningful as far as the individual students. And did we have other programs that specifically followed that growth model as much as this?
Chair Seaton, this was the first program that looked at this type of growth. We have another program. It's much more complicated, but it looks at growth, and it's something the federal government is allowing us to use to look at performance. And so we are able to look at growth of individual students in both of these methodologies that we have, this one being the most understandable to our educators and easiest to look at and really gauge student performance by. The reason we're able to do that in part is because we went to an assessment system where we give the same assessments, grades 3 through 10. In the past, our previous assessment systems had different assessment systems in different years. It was compliant, but it wasn't robust, I would say, and it didn't allow us to do these kinds of things. And so we now have a good assessment system that allows us to do that, and that's why those calculations and that analysis of performance, even if the performance incentive program is to go away, the analysis of growth over time is not going to go away. We also speak to, in terms of these accountability measures, we'll continue to use that, but we also are providing districts the data so that they can do that. They can look at that themselves in ways that we didn't used to do or weren't even capable of doing.
Well, good, and I think that just from my standpoint, I want to say that I think that just getting to this model, it has been worth whatever. I know this. I know the department's taken a lot of heat over the program and a lot of negative perception among educators, but I think that getting to a growth model, an individual student growth model, individual classroom growth model, individual school growth model, so we can say, did these kids learn more this year than we would have anticipated them learning in just an average setting, I think is that data and the information that the entire education system needs to actually increase our performance. And so I'm pleased that you're saying that we're going to continue with this assessment model, and I think that this is going to lead us to the accountability model that will actually let student performance increase. So I encourage you to massage that assessment and accountability mechanism in any ways that you can to come back with us or any ideas that we need to change to give you another reason to have to get there, because from everything I've seen, that gets us to the point where we're trying to get this entire education system. So, Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the same note, you helped me understand. I when I see the terms longitudinal data, I read growth model. You know, am I right or wrong?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, absolutely. It's all sort of moving together. We built an assessment system. Then there was a need, obviously, to look at the data. We knew that need would be there, so we've been building data systems to do that. They really all do fit together. The data system is hopefully something that allows local districts and schools to look at that so that it isn't just the state people working in the accountability office able to look at that data, but that educators working directly with students can look at that.
I just want to make sure I understood.
Representative Boot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to expand on your comments, too, if I might. I think that, you know, we're all looking for your particular, you know, if you were king kinds of attitudes. What could you do? What is it that you would do if you could do it? But along those same lines, going back down through, you know, the very, you know, latest hires in your divisions to providing incentives for those people to relook and provide you with, you know, any kind of motivations or incentives or, you know, kind of innovative looks that they might have as well. I mean, certainly, you know, we all have these motivational speakers and stuff come in and talk to all of us about all those kinds of things, but the encouragement that you provide within your own divisions, I think, is imperative, that you understand that you have the backing from this committee, that we want that encouragement from the ground up. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead. Okay.
Again, at this point, again, the things that I've been speaking to, I just want to remind you, are part of the accountability and assessment unit, which, again, Eric McCormick is now the director of that unit, but I work still closely, very closely with him. I want to speak to a couple other things and then have you have an opportunity to hear from Cynthia Curran, the Division of Teaching and Learning Support Director. In my current role as Deputy Director or Deputy Commissioner for the department, we have taken and brought in our work around the state system of support to bring support to districts, support to schools, and make it a department-wide initiative, providing technical assistance. And so I work with whatever division I need to deploy those, the kinds of supports that we need to put in place. When SB 285 passed last year, which again, we were very strongly supporting that because it helped us address things that we were hearing in the Moore versus Alaska lawsuit. Some funding came with that to provide technical assistance to districts, as well as some staffing came with that. Those staff worked directly for me in the commissioner's office, and we work to make sure we're meeting the needs of some of our districts that have some great challenges in front of them in terms of meeting student needs. So I provide the oversight to those activities, but I also work very closely with the directors to make sure we are coordinating our services, not just in now a new office or a new group working for me in the commissioner's office, but it's coordinated with and most of that coordination is with the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, because those are the folks out working with districts most frequently. In addition, I work closely with Ms. Curran to make sure that we're coordinating programs that are within her purview, such as the teacher mentor program, and make sure that the folks involved with that program are aware of what we're doing to try to support districts so that we're working together. We also have under the teacher mentor program, we have a principal coaching program. And so again, my role now, in addition to some of the duties as deputy commissioner that will traditionally be there, I work, my number one goal is to make sure our state system of support, of supporting our districts and helping them meet challenges, is met. And you also note that we're asking for some additional funding, about $800,000 for technical assistance this year. I would be the one deploying those funds to make sure that we are helping districts to improve math achievement, to improve language arts achievement, to make sure their curriculums are aligned to the state standards so that there is a focus in those districts, to make sure that the needs of the students are met so that they can perform well and have a successful experience in school. And so I wanted to make sure you were aware of my current role, which it, I think it also is a nice transition to having Cynthia Curran come up here and speak about the Division of Teaching and Learning Support.
Okay, and before you go, at some point in time, and it may be a formula or something else you can provide us, is, you know, in assessment, how do we determine what that average or anticipated growth year over year per student, per grade level should be? I mean, I know we're looking at this growth and modeling it versus anticipated growth, but and if it's complicated now, that's fine. Maybe you can get that to me later, but we kind of need to know how we develop that. This is what's anticipated growth.
Chair Seaton, I'd be happy to provide that. I think I could have some visual backup that will make it make better sense. So at a future time, we will make sure you have that information.
Okay, and that would be fine. Representative Munoz.
Thank you, Chairman. Since you brought up the mentoring program, I have just one quick question. Recently, I was traveling to a small community in Southeast, and I met one of the mentor teachers from Interior Alaska who had traveled to rural Southeast to mentor a teacher. And my question is, do you utilize teachers in the local area as mentors to help save travel costs and also to take advantage of local knowledge, so to speak?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, we do. We actually hire teachers from across the state, and many live in different hub cities. I don't know if we currently have any from Southeast Alaska or not, but we have in the past. I know of three educators out of Juneau that I used to be colleagues with that have been part of the mentor program. Each mentor is assigned, I believe, around 14 to 16 teachers that they work with throughout the state. Generally, we do try to keep them going also not only to an area closer to where their hub is, but also serve the majority of the teachers in an area close to where they're at. And it's something we've worked with the folks that administer the mentor program for us to try to create efficiencies through that. But there are times where someone will have to fly out of their area because perhaps of their content or grade level expertise or for other reasons of just trying to serve the whole state. But you raise a good question that I think early on in the program we work to try to, over the years, create more efficiencies in that area, and we may have to continue to do even more in that line.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Good morning again. For the record, my name is Cynthia Curran, and I am the Director of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support. TLS is a division within the Department of Education, and it is primarily funded through federal funds. The education program specialists, the education administrators, the deputy director, and the director are all certified teachers. What we do in the Division of Teaching and Learning Support is analyze and stay up to date with state and federal legislation and regulations, educational trends, standards and assessment activities, school improvement strategies, and research-based programs and strategies to help improve student achievement. We also take our knowledge and spread it around the state by providing some technical assistance when it is asked for by districts. We conduct meetings, institutes, conferences, and work sessions to help school staff meet the goals of various state and federal initiatives. We write grant applications for additional education funding for the state and school districts. We do collaborate with other state agencies, post-secondary educational organizations, nonprofits, business and community groups, and school districts to create and implement programs that help all students meet high standards. We issue requests for proposals, applications for funding, and issue grants and other contracts. Within the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, we also process applications for teacher certification, and we conduct monitoring visits and or paper monitoring. We do about 12 to 15 monitorings of districts each year, and it's on a five-year cycle to ensure compliance with federal and state requirements. And now what I'd like to do is go through the different programs within the Division of Teaching and Learning Support. And I'm going to start with the Title I.
Before we start on that, I wanted to, you had said one thing that you share this information or with districts when they ask. Do we have districts that don't ask that need to be told? I'm trying to figure out how to easily say this without offending either anyone, but did I understand that correctly, that this is a request, or do we also look through, I mean, I know we do through more through the lawsuit that said we have to supervise failing districts, but as far as districts that are just, shall we say, performing a little less than other districts, is there necessarily contact and sharing that way?
Chair Seaton, yes, recently we had the winter conference, and at that conference we invited districts and teachers to come to learn about programs. And from my experience with the highly qualified teachers, we have, for lack of a better term, inflicted ourselves to help districts that need help and invite them to technical assistance, basically whether they like it or not.
Okay.
So the mission of Title I NCLB is to support equitable student access to high-quality education and increase student achievement through efficient and appropriate provision of federal resources from the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which became the Improving America School Act, which became the No Child Left Behind Act. This unit implements federal programs under ESEA, provides technical assistance to district staff in applying for federal funds, reviews and approves their applications for those federal funds, and monitors the district use of funds, as I said previously, on a five-year cycle. The following programs fall under Title I. Title I-A, which provides funding to implement supplemental programs to improve student performance of low-achieving students in schools with the highest concentration of low-income families. Title I-C, migrant education funding, is for programs to assist migratory children in meeting high standards. Title I Part D is neglected and delinquent and at risk. And this program provides funding for state-operated institutions, coordination, and transition services to improve the quality of instruction, provides funding to school districts with the highest concentrations of delinquency to develop cooperative service agreements with agencies for instructional improvement, coordination activities, dropout prevention services, voc ed and support services, and coordinate further integration between special education and the Title I programs.
Before we go on, I think there's probably some questions on dropout prevention and delinquency. Representative Gardner?
I'm sorry, could you just repeat the program that all of those things fall under?
It's Title I Part D, okay. Neglected, delinquent, at risk.
Thank you. Yes, I think we're going to be very interested in this program. I don't have a specific question at this point. It's a mental note.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cindy, how do the schools, I know sometimes through the school lunch program you can find out which ones are low-income children, but there are some schools that don't have school lunch programs because they don't have a building or they don't have a room big enough with the right sinks and all that type of thing, so they can't have a school lunch program. How do the school, how do you pick then at which ones are low income? And I imagine that delinquent, because of things happening, the schools find out about that. But what about the at-risk kids? What kind of do you test them, or what happens for the schools to pick these students?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I am not familiar with how students are determined to be at risk. I can find that information out for you and provide it for you at a later time.
Thanks.
Let me just
certainly
follow up one more question on the delinquency. Delinquency, is that definition kids under 16 that aren't in school? Is that what we're talking about? We're not. Dropouts was another thing, but if they're over 16, are they, the requirement isn't there, so we're not talking about delinquency at that point. We're just encouraging continued participation and graduation. Yeah. Is that where we're at on this definition of delinquency, or do you have that with you now?
Chair Seaton, this is a federal program, and I am sure that the federal government has a wonderful definition of what delinquency is, and I will be happy to provide that for you.
Okay.
I don't have it with me.
And that's fine. We're asking a number of questions that I'm sure somebody will take notes on and get back to us, just like they have done, and those are fine. But that's what I'm trying to get to, is how we analyze and how we enforce that and how we identify those. Representative Book.
Thank you, Chair Seaton. On that same point, just to follow up, if we could get a state definition as well, if they're too different, appreciate that. Thank you.
Are you writing all this stuff down? Then I won't.
Also, within the Division of Teaching and Learning Support is the area of special education. And I believe that Representative Gardner asked about special education funding, how many students there are. Between the ages of 3 and 21 in the state, there are approximately 18,000 students who are identified as special needs students. The mission of special education is to ensure quality, standards-based instruction to improve academic achievement and social and behavioral skill development opportunities for all students. Unit staff ensures that the state and school districts comply with state and federal guidelines for the delivery of special education services and provides direct assistance to districts when requested or when needed. Within the special education unit is also the state improvement grant, which has one more year of funding, and that has funded a couple of teacher mentors, specifically knowledgeable about special education, to provide services for those new special education teachers. It has also provided funding to the Alaska Teacher Placement Center in order to help us recruit and hopefully retain more special education teachers, because I'm certainly aware that the committee knows that we have a dearth of special education teachers in our state. It's a national problem, and we are not immune. And next week, I believe you're talking about the early learning components, and they also fall within the special education unit due to the fact that early identification is a part of special education. Title II and teacher quality are also in the division, and teacher quality is the Title IIA program along with higher education grants. As you may know, teacher quality came down to the number of core academic courses taught by highly qualified teachers. Using federal guidelines, we developed those definitions and helped the districts in the state get their teachers highly qualified. The math-science partnerships are part of Title II. along with the higher education grants, these are competitive funds that go to high-needs districts in partnership with a university to provide professional development. Math science is specifically aimed at the math science teachers. The higher ed partnerships can be any subject area. Also within Title II is the transition to teaching, which would be Title II Part C, and the state, recognizing the fact that we have a teacher shortage, wrote and received a transition to teaching grant that is allowing us to provide an alternate route to teacher certification for qualified paraprofessionals, recent college graduates, and those folks who are mid-career professionals who may want to become teachers.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cindy, is this usually, Matt, is this usually maybe teacher's aides or someone that really finds that they just love what they're doing and they want to go on to teach? Or what kind of, where are we getting these teachers that want, you know, that you're going to transition?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, they're coming from actually all walks of life. We do have a few paraprofessionals who have expressed an interest in the program. Many recent college graduates, not being able to find jobs in their fields, are expressing interest in becoming teachers. And there are folks who started out in a different career path who decided that they want to give back, and so they're looking for a way to become a teacher that doesn't take them four more years of college. And so that's what this provides, the necessary education, the OJT, as it were, so that they can become teachers, high-quality teachers.
So this is definitely more than looking at those people in the trades that would then be eligible to go through, get a teaching certificate in a vocational education. This is somebody in business that would be teaching math or English or some other field like that. Just trying to get a little more understanding.
Chair Seaton, the state already has a program whereby those folks that are knowledgeable in the trades can become classroom teachers through a Type M certification. And this program, the federal requirement is at least a baccalaureate degree. And so those folks who might not have a baccalaureate degree would need another route. We're only providing it for those people who have a baccalaureate degree or higher.
Okay, and did I see a question? Representative Book?
Sorry.
Did we have? Representative Book.
Through the chair, could you briefly outline, are there any restrictions regarding age, things like that, that might be hamper your current availability of outreach for these replacement teachers?
Through the chair, Representative Book, I just want to clarify what you're asking. Are you asking that there is something that would preclude someone from being able to take advantage of this alternate route?
Thank you. Are there things that, like, through the requirements of the district or whatever, that age would be would hamper, as an example, a person from utilizing their skills?
Through the chair, Representative Buick, this program does not have any age limits. The requirements are that the person possess a baccalaureate degree at least, okay, or and be able to pass a background check and be able to pass the Praxis 1, which is a test of basic skills in reading, writing, and mathematics.
Thank you.
And Representative Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we get a list of those for the alternative certification program, what the prerequisites are? That's a department document?
Through the chair, Representative Keller, I'd be happy to provide that for you. Also under Title II is Title IID, which is the educational technology. And through this program, we provide resources to school districts on both a formula and competitive basis to update existing technology and integrate the use of technology in instruction. So there are professional development funds within Title IID. Moving on, we have career and technical education. Career and technical education provides leadership and support to local career and technical education programs that prepare students for further education and that result in family-supporting careers. This is the Carl Perkins funding that I know you've heard of. Within this unit, as Deputy Commissioner Moore said, resides the Alaska Career Ready Initiative. And the work keys that we spoke about, the American College Testing Service looked at thousands of occupations and profiled them to find out what skills one would need, basic skills, reading, locating information, applied mathematics for a variety of jobs. And what this program does is allow students to find out where they are and what kinds of jobs that they would be qualified for with certain skills. The win piece of that is actually the software that provides lessons so that students can go to the computer and do work, find out what they need more help in, do more work, and then the work keys assesses their skills in those areas.
Okay, thank you. Representative Boop.
Point of clarification. The mindset came from the College of what? Where did this program come from? Who was the originator and who developed the assessment?
Through the chair, Representative Book, the work keys assessment was developed by the American College Testing Service, ACT.
Right. Thank you. That's my, the point that I'm bringing up here is that this was college assessment for a program that is vocationally oriented, I guess. So I'm just trying to get a view of where some of these perspectives came from. Thank you.
Cynthia.
Through the chair, Representative Book, while ACT is a college testing program, they realized that there were other professions, other jobs out there that don't require a four-year education degree, but they do require a level of mathematics, reading to locate information, and being able to write. I've looked at some of the assessments and some of the WIN application, and there are things like writing a business letter or writing a complaint letter. The mathematics applications are actually real-world applications in a vocational type of setting, as well as other jobs that use mathematics.
Thank you.
Is we overflew Juneau a couple of years ago, and we're in Sitka and toured Mount Edgecombe, and they were using one of the, I guess there were two programs that were going to be available, or the one that they had available on, you know, this kind of program. Is this the one that Mount Edgecombe was using two or three years ago, or would that have been a different program? Do you,
Mr. Chair? I believe it would have been a different one, because this is something relatively new that we just started last year.
Okay. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I'm understanding right, this new one that we're using now will tell a student, I'm good at here, but boy, these other areas over here I'm not so good at, but I really want to go to college. So then it really tells that student that they're going to have to get down and really pay attention if they want to go on to college, or if their aptitude is such that they can say, if I want to be a beautician, I could qualify if I just did these two other things. Is that kind of what I'm hearing you say, or is it something totally different than that?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it's not a placement type of assessment. It's to open up thoughts of what kinds of skills are required to encourage students to get more skills so that they could be successful in any occupation that they would choose.
Is that program available on the web, or is it CD-based, or is there some way that the committee, I mean, there's just a difference of understanding of what this is. Can we get a copy of that so that we can play with it, or if you have it on a laptop that we could at least share it around and see so we have a better understanding of what that tool is?
Chair Seaton, I will find out how we can provide that for you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Wilson.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to, because it seems like last year, somewhere along the line, that I kind of got an overview of that program, and I probably wasn't understanding it as well as I should. So I would be interested in at least something so that I kind of understand better how that benefits the student. And I thought it was that it would tell them if they, you know, if they wanted to go into a certain area, whether they were ready to do that or whether they really needed to do something else quite a bit in order to accomplish what they wanted to do. So I thought it was connected with professions a little bit, so they would know if they had to go on further, or if they had to learn a lot more, or if they said, oh golly, I've only taken basic math, and for that I really need several other math.
Representative Wilson, maybe what we can do is, if there's a one of the other schedules here where we could take a few moments, we can set up a laptop in here, and if we can mm-hmm. you know, have a quick demonstration or something for the whole committee instead of individually, that might be the easiest way for us. And that would be the case with any other of the educational tools or assessments or anything else. It would be helpful for us. And I'm going to also request that if the commissioner gave us his notes on his speech, which are helpful, and everyone has those in the packet. And if you're able to, you know, we don't need a huge white paper, but if we can kind of summarize where you were today through the presentation, that would be helpful for us, because we can only write so much as we're going along through here. So does that satisfy you, Representative Wilson? Okay. Go ahead.
The next area within the unit of teaching and learning support is child nutrition services. And child nutrition services provides administrative oversight that ensures that federal regulations are met by the programs that are eligible to receive federal meal reimbursements. It offers USDA meal programs to school districts, residential child care institutions, family daycare homes, child and adult daycare centers, and summer food programs. There are approximately 70,000 meals served daily over 1,000 locations statewide. CNS, Child Nutrition Services, also distributes the USDA commodity foods statewide to schools and provides temporary emergency food assistance through food banks and congregate feeding sites across the state. In 2009, CNS will distribute more than 3,316,499 pounds of USDA surplus food within Alaska.
Well, that's great. And on the food program, I know that we've had a number of contacts, I'm sure other representatives as well, about the breakfast program as mm-hmm. well as the lunch program. And so at some point in time, we would really like to get drilled down in and find out the department's ability to work with that breakfast program and what that would require for, you know, doing that through a greater portion of Alaska than is currently available. I mean, we've, you know, I think we're all on board that if kid's hungry, he's not learning nearly as well. So appreciate that.
our grants and contracts unit, all the federal and state funds that flow through, they're responsible for making sure that we do everything that we're supposed to do and comply with all federal and state requirements for accepting funds. They work with the program managers, like the Title II program manager, to make sure that math science partnership funds would be expended in appropriate ways.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. On page 3 of the of our budget, and I'm sorry, Cindy, I don't know if you have this, but it basically shows a significant, it compares the 2009 plan to the 2010 and the governor's plan and the percentage change, and it's just under a 30% increase. And is that that we're serving more children or that costs have increased or a combination? Do we know? It's page 3, about just below the middle of the page.
Through the chair, Representative Gardner. On page 3, this represents just the general fund. And so that increase is totally based on salary increments. And so the management plan for FY 2009 shows 66.7. The governor's budget includes 86.6, which is, I believe, all due to contractual agreements with the bargaining units. And so that's why it's shown a 29.8. So if you were to actually move back to page, or actually move forward to page 4, you'll see all funding sources, which includes the federal, and then you'll see that the difference is a 0.1%.
Yes, thank you.
Title III is our English language acquisition program. It provides grants and technical assistance to eligible school districts applying for funding aimed at increasing English language acquisition of limited English proficient students. Under Title IV, which is, we call it our health health reading group, we have drug and violence prevention.
And before you go on, just wonder, we are going over time a little bit. If someone, Representative Munoz has another meeting, if anyone else does, I understand that, but I think that we want to go ahead and see if we can allow you to finish your presentation here. So go ahead.
We have drug and violence prevention, which provides resources, technical assistance, and grant assistance to districts to develop comprehensive alcohol and drug abuse prevention and intervention programs. Under Title IV is the governor's drug prevention, which was federally funded, provides grants to local schools and communities for prevention programs. We have the Title IV 21st Century Community Learning Centers. These grants go to districts and nonprofit educational agencies to provide before and after school programs that are based on academic standards and related school subjects. So it's another way to help kids meet high standards that's not necessarily more of the same during the school day type work. It ties in other ways of getting kids to get content.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Cindy, is this where it would be of benefit to the schools if they had the testing of the kids that fill out different surveys, if they were able to do that a little easier so we could get more kids, that we would be able to get more money from the feds to do these programs?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I know that this group administers the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. I am not sure of the tie-in between that and federal funding. There are certain things that we have to report on, suspensions, expulsions, those kinds of things. I don't know what the direct link is between that sort of thing and the funding. I will find out for you.
Okay. Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So I guess the question would be, does the school give the money, or is it under Title IV so that the money, if I understand right, the feds want to have make sure that there's a program where they can prove that there's been an improvement, and if they don't have that information, then they don't get a grant. And is that a federal grant, or is that a grant from the school or from the state?
These are, the Title IV grants are federal grants.
Okay, thank you.
Within this unit, there's work on counseling, providing funding for staff development training and programmatic activities related to healthy life skills, suicide prevention, and at-risk students. It also supports the Safe Schools and the Quality Schools Initiative. There's HIV prevention also falls under this, providing technical and financial support for school districts to develop HIV AIDS prevention curriculum, obtain classroom materials, and receive teacher training, conduct assessments and develop local policies and procedures related to HIV AIDS education. Reading First is another program within our unit, and as you know, the funding for Reading First is going away, but we have had great success in our state with the professional development and use of the programs in some of our highest need schools. We're very proud of what our teachers and students have been able to accomplish with those funds. There's also funding for fetal alcohol syndrome, support for locally based FAS teams to address the needs of children with fetal alcohol syndrome or fetal alcohol effect. As I said earlier, this unit works with the Department of Health and Social Services to help provide some of these services. We also, within our unit, have charter schools and correspondence schools. The state applies for federal grant funds for charter schools to be able to open up. And we are in the process of making another application so that we can have more charter schools.
That's for the initial opening grants, what is it, 3 years?
Chair Seaton, that is for the planning and the beginning operation of a charter school, yes. Title V Innovative Programs provides resources to school districts for school improvement and innovation. Once again, that's federal funds. We have the statewide correspondence programs. We issue, collect, and approve applications to operate statewide correspondence programs. I already spoke about the REAP, Small Rural Schools Achievement Program. Teacher certification is a unit within Teaching and Learning Support, and for the last 8 years, I was the education administrator in charge of teacher certification. Teacher certification accepts applications, evaluates and analyzes those applications, and issues certificates for teachers, administrators, and special service providers in the state. It is also responsible for the implementation of the highly qualified teacher requirements, as I said before, and the highly qualified teacher plans that are required by the federal government to prove that we are making our best effort to meeting the qualifications, the 100% goal set by the federal government.
41, Representative Boop.
Yes, on this topic, I did have some issues with this particular problems this summer, and I would like to discuss that in detail. If there's an appropriate time in some of your presentation, and you're going to cover that further, but there was some problems with certifications this summer with some of my constituents that are teachers in getting them in a timely manner. So if there's some support that we need to provide in that manner for staffing or, I don't know if that particular component of your division has had some technical problems or whatever, but there was some problems getting the certification in a timely manner in that the certification ran out while these professionals were trying to maintain their office, and without their certificate, they were actually out of compliance. So there is some problems there, and I would like to talk about that in helping you, you know, solve these dilemmas. Thank you.
And maybe what I can ask is that you can get us some data on length of time and those kind of things. I know, sir, there have also been in the past some real problems with the fingerprint requirement that people could get their federal, you know, the FBI would do the check, and yet the state wouldn't take the fingerprint requirement that, you know, here the FBI is saying, yep, these are okay, but the state wasn't. So that's going to be, I know there's some issues around certification and timeliness, and I think that there'll be more questions that we really have time for today. So as long as we can have you come back, or somebody come back with some information on certification, the problems, the length of time after normal application, you know, how that fingerprinting, how we're going to solve that, whether that's a state law or regulation change that we need to accept FBI fingerprinting and out, you know, whatever that situation is. I know there's a number of parameters around there. And Representative Keller, did you have a question on that as well?
Not on that.
Okay.
If you want me to wait.
Will that work out for you to get us some information on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we'd be happy to provide that. And in regards to Representative Book's situation this summer, I do have to I know there's issues, everything that you were talking about, but we did have specific issues this past year with our internal infrastructure, with our servers, with the way the data is stored on an optical disk platform. So we have gone through a process of upgrading the system, and so I'm kind of going to shoulder a lot of the blame for this because it is under my purview. We had lots of staff turnover, and like I said, we had infrastructure issues, and so a lot of the problems that we had this year were directly related to the infrastructure, and so we hope to correct that. But Cindy would be happy to provide you with the other information concerning the issues you brought up.
And Cindy, go ahead, and then we'll get to Representative Book.
Through the Chair, Representative Book, and members of the committee, I want you to know that the Commissioner Ledoux is convening a group of stakeholders to work on the issues with teacher certification. We're meeting February 11th and 12th to see what we can do with regard to statutes that may need to be changed, regulations, what processes within the office could be changed to better meet the needs of teachers and districts. So I want you to know that this is an ongoing issue for us and that we are attempting to address it. I'll be happy to get you all the information that we have regarding teacher certification.
Okay, and then follow up Representative Booth and then Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not trying to finger point here or blame or whatever. We're moving forward here, and you know, I have no interest in fault finding. That's really not my interest whatsoever. So I just want to put that on the table, that I want to acknowledge your experience, your expertise, and work with you and see how we can, you know, my concern is that some of these issues are technical, and that, you know, how can we provide better services on our end for you guys? Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to make a comment that your department isn't the only department that is having trouble with fingerprints and getting things the way they, you know, there's other departments like DOT that require that, and they're having similar problems. So it's just a fact of life that we're going to have to try to get a handle on and see how we can do it in better ways. You know, some people have to travel from Rango to Juneau to get their fingerprints when there's a police station right there. So I mean, you know, so those things are just things that I think overall is something that overall the state has to decide how they're going to do it and what's an easy way for the person that needs to do that. So
Representative Keller?
Different topic. Good.
Different topic.
I'm afraid we're going to run out of time. We've
well ran out of time. since everybody's still here.
I want to compliment you, Cindy, on your presentation, the different title funding. I mean, I don't think I've ever understood it as well as what you presented, and I appreciate that. Is there a way to, do you have easily available to you a, like a,
maybe a pie chart or something that shows where the federal money is going by title and by program, and just kind of something visual that we can look at, because it helps us to drill down, and it's important to us because of the fact that the national federal constitution leaves it to us to do the education, and yet this is how we get policy imported, is through this money. And to be able to identify how much money, federal money, for example, is being spent on Title 3D compared to Title 1A would really be helpful to me. If you have something like that, I sure would appreciate it.
Through the chair, Representative Keller, thank you. And I will be happy to find that information and provide it for you. I'm pretty sure we have it in a chart already, so we could do that.
Thank you.
Representative Boot.
Same point. Through the chair, thank you. Last summer, there was a dilemma I faced with the airport. I asked the airport to provide me with a flow chart of their operations. So from the top down, right to the bottom, I'm sure you already have it. You have a mechanism by which we can see where all of these divisions lie, from the federal government right on down to the state government. I know that you guys do these in your own presentation, so for my benefit, a flowchart would work for the agencies, the hierarchies, and how this all comes down to us.
Through the chair, Representative Butte, I'd be happy to find that information and provide it for you. Pull it together, as it were.
Thank you very much.
Have you finished, or do you have more to go?
Deputy Commissioner Moore spoke to you about the teacher mentoring program, so unless you have questions about that, I think that I am done.
Okay, I'd just like to say that, you know, I've talked to a number of teachers that are mentors and a number that have had mentoring, and that's been extremely successful program, and I'm at least that's the feedback that I've gotten from both sides of that situation. And so I hope we'll and also the administrative side of it as well that we've expanded to. So appreciate that. And if there's no other questions today, we really appreciate it. We'll appreciate receiving your outline or notes or whatever that you can provide us, so that we can stay refreshed on all of these things and better understand them, because there's a lot of information to go through shortly. And Representative Book, a final comment?
Yeah. I thank you, Mr. Chairman. Several years ago, I was instructed that if I really want to learn a little bit about this, that I ought to find out some commentary, and I was instructed to go to a gentleman by the name of Jamie Vollmer. Jamie Vollmer has done some studies on education system. 200 years ago, we asked our students to learn reading, writing, in the English lighting, and math. And now we encumbered our education system with several pages, if you will, of itemized requirements. And I'm interested in going forward with your help in finding out how I can educate parents that you're there to educate but not raise their kids. So, you know, we're going to be faced with some real serious dilemmas of monies in the not-too-distant future. We're not going to be able to provide all the kinds of things we have been. And I think that basic education is a requisite that society is going to command, and we're going to have to do that at the best that we possibly can with the funds allowed. And I think part of the education that is my responsibility is to teach the parents that there are obligations out there that we've assumed that we will probably not be able to continue. And I'd like your help in that.
And thank you very much. And without further comments, then we will be adjourned, and it is at 10:18.